got a bag of funds, haters as well. Everything you post on the game,
true, 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 true.
Everything you post on the game, a problem.
CK3FM, Montreal. Montreal.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
And you're listening to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM, third Thursday of the month on Off the Hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your co-host, Mustafa Henaway, and I'm always joined with
Stefan Doucet, your other co-host. We got a real packed show today, so we're going to keep it short and sweet. Today we've got Jeff Begley. He's the president of the Health and Social Services Federation of CSN, so FSSS-CSN, to talk about public sector negotiations sort of through the years, over the past almost 50 years now since the 1972 Common Front. And
We'll be joined with the Caregivers Action Center in Toronto with two incredible interviews, one of them Diana Da Silva, as well as Harpy Carr, who is also was a caregiver and is a caregiver herself. So it's a really great show we have this month.
As always, you can find us on Facebook and you can listen to the show afterwards if you want to download it on CKUT's website or on our own Mixcloud. So find us on Facebook where you'll find all that information. And thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you. And stay tuned for next month too. This is Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
So welcome back to Labor Radio on CKUT. We're fortunate enough to be joined on the line with Jeff Begley. He's the president of the Fédération de la Santé des Services Sociaux, CSN, one of the biggest sections of the CSN. If not the biggest, if I'm not mistaken. And he's also involved in the public sector negotiations that are ongoing as we speak. And that's the subject of today's interview with him. So thanks so much, Jeff, for coming on with us today.
My pleasure.
So, Jeff, I mean, I guess the very first question that I mean, and to go back is to set the stage. How did we actually end up coming to, because I think for many listeners, probably outside of Quebec, there's sort of a uniqueness to the entire, to the way that public sector bargaining and negotiation actually takes place in Quebec. So if you can talk about sort of the beginnings of the Common Front and the public sector negotiations.
Basically, the beginning, it was the unions that asked that this be a centralized process way back. You have maybe some of your older listeners or people that are interested in the labor movement may remember the famous Common Front of 1972. That was before I was in Quebec, and even if I had been here, I was just a little taught. But it's something of a mythic. It took mythic proportions, where basically people working in the public sector were asking that the minimum, the base salary, be $100 a week. And this mobilized the public sector workers all over Quebec. The government basically, the pressure was enormous. They had tried to stop the mobilization, and there was decrees and so on and so forth. And the union leaders of that time said no, despite the decree, we're keeping going. And they were actually put in jail, the three union leaders from the CSN, the CSQ at the time, which was the CEQ at the time, which was the teachers, the CSN, obviously, especially Health and Social Services, CJEPs, and as well as the FTQ workers that were in public sector. And the three leaders were put in jail because they refused to put an end to the mobilization that was happening. And obviously, once they were in jail, then that just increased the determination of the workers to say, hey, this $100 an hour a week, pardon me, $100 an hour, I wish, but $100 a week salary, that's the bare minimum. Less than that, we will not stop our mobilization. And at that time, obviously, strikes weren't as, how can I say, they weren't as regulated as they are now in the public sector, especially in health and social services. So it had a huge impact.
Can you sort of take us, like, even just a little bit before 1972? Because I think what's unique about Quebec is this central bargaining table, right? Or maybe you can actually just explain that, because from what I know of bargaining outside of Quebec, you just have unions negotiating with the government on a sort of one-to-one basis. Here it's not like that. And I think that would, that might be one of the sort of founding, or one of the basic building blocks to understand how this came about in 1972, the Big Common Front, but also all the way till today, where we still have like this unique structure for negotiations.
Yeah, well, at the beginning, obviously, the from the union perspective, the possibility of putting everybody together that negotiates with the government, because obviously governments and they've started even within the negotiation structure of the public sector now, the last three governments that we've seen have been playing a lot of divide and conquer. And so when this started, it was a way of putting an end to the divide and conquer. We're all in this together. The minimum wage that we want, it's good for all of our members. It's good for the economy of Quebec. It's good for... So basically, when it started, the idea was to limit their possibility of playing divide and conquer. And There was also, I must say, for the government, there was some good things in the sense that they could have a certain knowledge of, for instance, once you negotiate, like in Ontario with the government, there's literally hundreds of negotiations. So to coordinate all that and know the impacts on the budget and so on and so forth, it's an immense bureaucratic nightmare, which at the beginning, at least for Quebec, that was kind of the win side for the government, having at one place the negotiations around salary questions, because we must be clear, the negotiations that are centralized are all about salary and money issues such as pension fund, parental leave, and so on and so forth. So it was kind of a win for the government. Anyways, it was for the government, there was an upside. I wouldn't go as far as saying that they saw it as a win, but they saw that as an upside. And obviously for the unions, like I say, limiting the possibility for the government to play divide and conquer. But obviously governments adapt to the situation. And the end of the 90s, we started seeing that this push, obviously, and in Quebec, it's always a few years later, that we had Reagan in the 80s in the United States. By the time that this philosophy of austerity and cutting services and so on and so forth. That came more towards the middle of the 90s. I would say probably that the first real government to say, okay, let's start attacking the way we finance services was probably Daniel Johnson in the mid 90s. Today, Robert Bourassa, who was long time Prime Minister of Quebec, Premier of Quebec, would be definitely, if he was still in the Liberal Party, he would be definitely on the left of the Liberal group now. But that's drastically changed. Philippe Couillard, who was longtime Premier of Quebec in the Bourassa years, probably would not have been in the Liberal Party. He would have been something more like the Union Nationale or something much more conservative. So there's been an evolution, and it started, I'd say, probably middle 90s with Daniel Johnson. And obviously for governments, generally speaking, that's the other thing in Quebec, up until the middle 90s, unions were pretty much, I wouldn't go so far as to say revered, but respected. By the general population and by successive governments, because the early battles of unions, whether in Quebec, were especially some of the famous battles, the Cadbury, anyways, foreign nationals, international companies that came, that had no respect for the people that were working with them, oftentimes no communication with the employer in French. And he had, obviously, basically speaking, just French speaking workers. And so at the beginning, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, generally speaking, people had a respect for unions because they were defending the worker population, which was very predominantly French, against people that wanted to exploit these workers. So that having that respect made it much easier to say, now you're going to negotiate with the public sector, everybody. And nobody really questioned it. And I think even if the government was had certain reserves about getting on to that, the popularity, or at least, once again, popularity isn't the best word, but the respect that people had for the fight that unions led, they said, yeah, if it's good for the people that are working at Dominion Plywood, why isn't it good for people working in the public sector? Especially since public sector workers, the history of Quebec, it's come out of the church that did the schools, the hospitals. In the history of the Federation, the book that we have, when you look at what was happening in the 40s and 50s in hospitals, and the fact that this is a charity that you're offering to the population. So people were massively underpaid. So yeah, there was in the 60s with the quiet revolution in the beginning of the 70s, everything just came together to say yes, essential negotiations, and it's stayed ever since.
One thing, Jeff, I wanted to ask you about, because this was something reminiscent about the early days of the Common Front, was not just about the key demands and the strategy that the three unions, that the Common Front took, which was also larger social demands, not just around public services, but expanding them, right? And sort of that, you know, in 72 and also in the 80s around daycare. So if you talk about that sort of that strategy in terms of also how unions try to broaden that respect by making these pinning these other demands and whether or not that was a successful strategy. Maybe also how it relates to, I think today there's also to rethink that strategy that was taken by the Common Front in those early days.
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. Marcel Pépin, who was president of the CSN, who was one of the three that went to jail, he had a major impact on the CSN, and like I say, there's a history there with the link with the church and everything. But by the time Marcel Pépin came along, the Catholic part of the CSN was being put more and more aside. And Marcel Pépin, his philosophy, the way he put things on the table, he said, listen, if we fix salaries, but people don't have needs met that are basic needs outside of the workplace, then the average worker isn't advanced. You know, at that time, the possibility for a worker to send his kids to, well, CJEP didn't exist. It was the classic, I forget how we call the schools at the time that prepared for university. And the most of the population in French had very little access to university. So Pépin said, his philosophy was to say, it's great for the worker that we improve his salary conditions, but if he has no access to send his kids to CJEP or to university, if he has no access, because remember that was right around the time where we were starting to implement public health care. So a lot of these, and it was the same thing with access to legal services and so on and so forth. They said, the worker isn't just a worker, he's a whole person. And we have to be, the first front is the front of the negotiation, and there's a second front, his life outside, after work, because obviously he's working to make sure that his life is adequate, and more than adequate, is fulfilling outside of the workplace. And for that to be the case, then we have to be preoccupied by larger social issues. And the union movement, although in some cases wasn't the primary tool to get these things, participated. For instance, CLSCs were created starting from local community clinics. The Clinique Point Saint-Charles was the one of the biggest and most well-known and one of the first community clinics, and was the model that eventually served to create CLSCs. And the union movement participated actively to say, the government, you have a responsibility to make sure that people have access to the services they need in their community. Same thing with I'm searching the English word, but clinique juridique, the
legal aid, yeah.
Legal aid was born out of community legal clinics so that people could have some kind of an access when they needed to consult a lawyer. And this is what led to legal aid. So basically, unions have been behind these kinds of movements, and I would mention one where we were an integral part of it, was the creation of the daycare system that we have in Quebec, where there was really a fantastic movement. That was at the beginning of my implication at the CSN, where the workers, even though there was only about 25% that were unionized, the unionized workers had the means because they could meet and talk about the needs of the sector, the parents, the employers, And with the PQ government at the time, Pauline Marois, were able to really, over a couple of years, just revolutionize what's happening in daycare centers. And that is a model for most people that wish outside of Quebec, that would wish to have the access that we have here in Quebec. It's a constant battle to keep it and to improve it. But that's another example of, you know, yes, the workers that are there, that's something for them. But it was a much larger implication, and unions got behind it, not just because they represented workers, but because most of our members are at one time or another parents that needed those services and didn't have them at a reasonable price. So that's a few examples.
So we've talked a little bit about, like, or you mentioned a few in that answer of those sort of key victories or the sort of public services that were built sort of through the pressure and the demands of the labor movement. I don't want to leave us without time to discuss the current public sector negotiations, but just to take us through from 72 to today, do you want to maybe bring up like a few other key moments in these negotiations? Maybe they could be ones that you participated in or not, but just to take us from 72 and maybe through the Couillard years to now, like what are some things that have shaped these negotiations and maybe changed their character over the years?
Well, I would say between 72 and 95, conditions in the public sector improved enormously. Our members were at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, were considered that they had really adequate conditions, and that they were determined to keep them. Like I mentioned, Daniel Johnson, that was the first really move to kind of change things. And these things work in kind of, what's the word? These things work in cycles, you know, where you're going up, you're for 2, 3, 4 negotiations where you're getting major concessions. And then you hit a down cycle, depending obviously on how your vis-a-vis also sees things. So the first attack on working conditions in the public sector was Daniel Johnson, and it wasn't a huge attack, and we weren't able to stop everything, but several of the things that he had wanted to do. So that was the first attack, but the big one was with the arrival of Jean Charest, who there was and I would say the Liberal Party itself took a huge turn when Charest arrived. It was much more conservative, austerity oriented, return money to the people by taxing them less, and the services, well, that's the price to pay. So the big negotiation that was a really difficult negotiation was the first one after Charest arrived in 2005, 2006. And then the one situation I think that turned everything around, and that now they've gone too far, was 2015 with the reform of the health and social services sector. And it's true for the health and social services sector, but it's true in a whole lot of other things where the public, they don't notice. I'll give you one example, health and safety, the Health and Safety Board, which during this pandemic could have played a huge role. Well, they were merged with two other groups, government entities, essential services, and pay equity. So now you've got this huge group that is responsible for a whole bunch of things. And obviously, when we merge them, the idea is to cut costs. And what they're saying, and even I'm amazed that Kath took that up last week, saying, you know, we're not going to cut services, we're just going to cut administrations because it's too big. Well, we saw what that did with Barrett. We're seeing what that's done. We're seeing a good example this last year, the impact of that for the Health and Safety Board, who is not able to fill their mandate when we're in a pandemic crisis. It's something that's boring for the public, that they just say, oh, if it saves money, go ahead. But the real impact we've seen. And it's the same thing with negotiations. We, before this negotiation started, we were really, really hopeful that for our people, because I think we've seen with the pandemic, when it started, people were already exhausted in health and social services, and it's true also in other sectors, education, and so on. But since I'm in health and social services, it's there where I noticed. For us, there was no surprise that the health and social services network was not able to be was able to perform as much as people would have liked to, because we had the reorganization of 2015 was a disaster on all the line. And we're talking about centralization of the negotiations, but for the salary policies, but there was a deep, it wasn't so centralized with things around, for instance, up until the changes when the first government, Charette government came in, we used to negotiate 12 different collective bargaining agreements, one for the CLSCs, one for the CHSLDs, one for the hospitals and so on, Les Centres Jeunesse. Now, we negotiate by category. There's four categories, one collective bargaining agreement for everybody. Province-wide, that's in that category. So that's been, with the reform, what's happening is that, and we saw it before, a CHSLD had a board of directors, each one had a board of directors who, when a problem came up, they were made aware and they found a solution. Now, if the CHSLD gets 10 minutes every month at the board of directors meeting, then it's been a good meeting. They had a lot of time because everything's concentrated, especially when it's a university hospital, but regardless, on the emergency department, the waiting lists for surgery, everything else is secondary. So that's why it was a crisis waiting to happen when this pandemic arrived. And like I say, we were hopeful because our people were already noticing what a disaster this was, that we had big plans for a huge mobilization around working conditions, but also the conditions with which services were given. And when the pandemic arrived, people that were already tired but were ready to fight now had to give everything to make sure that the population is getting the services. So this has been a huge challenge despite being so tired, to get people to understand that if we don't win this negotiation, if we don't win something substantial, next year, it won't be the unions that are going to, it'll be just everybody saying, goodbye, I've had enough, I've given everything I've got. So that's where we are now. the advantage of having been a year since the beginning of the pandemic, the way that the government was talking at the beginning, they wanted to come to an agreement in the next weeks after the beginning of the pandemic, except they did nothing to get to that point. And once again, they're continuing to play divide and conquer, putting young teachers against older teachers, putting nurses against everybody else in the health and social services sector, for our members, sometimes it's kind of a temptation to say, well, so-and-so, they have what such and such a group had their turn, it's our turn. I think we're at a point where it's everybody's turn. And if we don't start recognizing, and this is probably the one big, one of the bigger, because I probably have five or six critics about the way Legault has handled the pandemic. But one of the biggest one is continuing to divide and conquer. What a terrible time to do that. It was exactly the time to call upon everybody to say, we need everybody and thank you to everybody. And not only in words, but in actions. So anyways, I probably kind of got off track a bit, but if you want to bring me back, go ahead.
I'd actually like to bring you back, because you talked about it in a bit, but in sort of the impact of what Couillard had done in 2015, and sort of how did that fundamentally shape public sector negotiations, right? Even from union representation now in the health sector and or in the public sector, how that specifically impacted CSN and sort of the success of that divide and conquer and what that did to the common front.
Good question. Okay. Yeah. So let's remember Couillard when he left as Minister of Health and Health and Social Services Minister in the Charette government to work in the private sector. He worked with a think tank whose objective was to privatize public health services as much as possible. So for him, the priority was to permit the private sector to take more and more of a place in offering health and social services. And it's been immensely successful. They're really, you know, people know about the clinic, Rockland, and so on and so forth. With the consolidation, and that started in 2003 with Couillard as minister, and then the big step in 2015 with Barrette, the way it worked, he said, okay, we're consolidating. We're putting all these groups together. So we went from more than 1,200 different establishments in the public sector. We consolidated them into 34 establishments, the CIS and the CIUS. At the same time, we said for the government, it wasn't something that was said, but it was part of the objective also, and it wouldn't have been necessary to react in this way. They said, okay, at the same time, we're gonna consolidate the unions. So first of all, we're gonna divide them into four groups, four categories. Before, if you worked in an establishment, you could have more than one union, but you could all be in the same union if you wanted to be. Now that's impossible. You have to have an accreditation for each category. Plus, your categories are in, like I say, CHSLD, Saint Jeunesse, CLSCs, hospitals, readaptation centers. So all these people coming together on a huge basis. So before, where probably our average union had 200 to 300 members, now in the public sector and health and social services, there are 3,000 to 5,000 members. And once you get outside the island of Montreal, see, even Quebec, the union that is working in the CIUSSS of the La Capitale Nationale, which is Quebec City, it goes from Quebec City to La Pactière, de La Pactière à Charlevoix, the Saguenay River. This is a huge, huge, huge area with, and people belong to the same union, and the possibilities of the dialogue that we have, it's a much, much bigger, challenge. So this is why it's kind of a paradox. He's centralized to make sure that he can continue to play the divide and conquer game. And I think, you know, once you recognize that the employers have a really tough time, like now in a CHSLD, before when you had a board of directors at that place, may the whole group of the employer and his team were on the place. Now it's not unusual. Members will tell me, working in a CHSLD, that they've never seen their boss in person, or they see him once a month, that he's at the Siège Social, at the headquarters of the CIUSSS, and they might talk to him by Zoom once in a while. And so, or that the boss that is in place, the management that is in place, doesn't have the authority to do very much. They always have to check back with the head office. So imagine with bosses, the employers that are having a tough time managing things, and they have 100 times the resources of unions, and they have a tough time. So for unions, this has been a huge challenge. And then with the pandemic, it just exploded as a challenge. Our members are trying to get back on, because like I say, and to get back to the negotiation, the actual negotiation with what's happened over the last few times, the problem this time is if the government wants to profit, and in the worst sense of the term, from this crisis, to impose conditions on workers in the health and social services sector, it's not unions is going to be punishing. It's the health and social services network that he's going to be punishing, when there'll be a mass exit of people over the next year and a half.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff. That's about all the time that we have. I wish we could do this maybe two or three times as long, but it just means that we'll have to have you back maybe to talk about the outcome of the negotiations when you guys will have taken such a victory that you got the whole sector back on its feet.
Listen, anyways, we're going to give our people the chance to do that. But we don't underestimate the situation, but it's been my pleasure. If ever, don't hesitate. If I can, I will. It's been a pleasure to talk about something a little bit more globally instead of very specific.
Well, thanks so much again. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jeff.
You bet. Thank you.
So we're joined on the line with Harpreet Kaur. She's a migrant care worker, and Diana Da Silva, a organizer with the Caregivers Action Center. We're going to talk a little bit about care work under COVID. So welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
So maybe we'll start with Harpreet. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing lately? So I know the organization existed before COVID, the issues existed before COVID, but COVID has obviously had a pretty dramatic effect on your work, being that you work, quote unquote, from home, but just in someone else's home. So can you tell us a little bit about the work that has been happening sort of on the front lines of defending the rights and fighting for the rights of migrant care workers in Canada?
Is a COVID-19 is very affect life care workers, and especially they have faced a lot of problems, and they're working long hours in houses because all family are at home, and they employers they don't allow to go outside if they want to send money, if they want to buy food, and they do not allow because they are scared. And if they want to go for a walk and they said, okay, you can't go if they have a holiday, but they are going, but next day they are fired because they are going for a walk. So that time is very hard for care workers.
I think that was one of the first things that came to mind for me when I was thinking just in general, like, you know, being someone who's obviously interested in labor and how people work and what their working conditions are. normally when people talk about how COVID has affected people's work, it means that they, I don't know, maybe if they still go to a workplace, maybe they're more exposed to the virus. But if they work from home, it means they are isolated. Or they struggle with computers all the time. But so as a care worker, it's more like the boss is home all the time now. Your boss is more surveillance, there's longer hours. Can you talk a little bit about how that, what changed? Like how this affected the experience of working as a care worker?
Yes. Before the COVID, everything was normal and maybe some problems for every care workers. So in the COVID, they are doing long hours, but sometimes they don't pay that hours. And mostly some care workers are stuck in house because they don't allow to go outside even 4 months, 5 months, and employer they themselves are going to outside, but then they are not scared. But when care workers are going, so they are scared. So that is more affected the life because friends, care workers, some are friends in one city. They are hard to see each other because they don't allow to go. So there are so many conditions, and some care workers are fired because they said because they are fed up. They are living in one place 3-4 months, and they want to go for a little bit walk, and another day they are fired. So that is more problems in a care worker's life, and. For requirements, we are requirements, and they need to book the IELTS exam for permanent residency, but they couldn't find the center because the COVID-19 center are closed. It's very hard and education assessments, they're taking too long time. And for PR processing is crazy. Like we are waiting so long time for our result for permanent residency. So that is more effective.
I can jump in here if that's all right. Harpreet brings up really great points that care workers, migrant care workers, have closed work permits, which means that you are tied to one employer. And employers can easily take advantage of workers and have a lot of power and control over the lives of workers, especially those who live in the employers' homes. And just like Harpreet was saying, they're living in fear. They're being overworked, and they were overworked before COVID, and now they're even more overworked because employers were at home. And you would think that that by employers being at home, that some of the workload would be taken off the worker, but in fact, it was the complete opposite. Workers had to, especially childcare workers, they had to be full-time teachers, full-time cleaners, full-time chefs, on top of taking care of children. So we saw, you know, the hyper intensification of work, and then workers being trapped and not even being able to send money back home or buy groceries, and being fired just for anything. So we saw the hyper intensification of work, and then we saw the complete opposite, where workers were constantly being fired for just their basic rights, like being able to leave and go for a walk. It's been ridiculous, and it's because of the fact that workers do not have permanent immigration status that allows employers to be able to control their lives and their futures here in Canada.
I was wondering maybe if you could talk about the difference, or rather, I know that these structures that you're part of, the Caregivers Action Center, the struggles around the rights of caregivers, like you mentioned, they existed before the pandemic. So have the demands changed? Has there been specific demands in relation to the pandemic? Or is it just kind of even more seriously illustrate the needs for these basic demands? I guess I'm asking, is there more short-term demands that have come up because of the pandemic that need to be addressed right now, and that are different than the historic demands of the movement?
Yes. So we are fighting for status for all, but we have few demands. We want to remove IELTS. We want to remove post-secondary school diploma, and we want to remove just 2 years, 2 years work with the employers, that's requirement. So we have some more. So because basically caregivers are doing very hard work, and they are sacrificed a lot for Canada's people and their back home's family. So some girls can't pass the IELTS exam because they are doing work, very hard work. They don't have enough time for study. And if they are going for post-secondary school, they don't have enough money to pay the college fees and that thing. So this is, we have this demand. So we are launching our demands on May 9th. So that's why we want to, government should do something for caregivers, and they should change some things.
And to add to that, you know, the demand for landed status now, status for all, is a demand that has been for decades, for migrant workers have been asking for. But right now, care workers are going through some very specific challenges because of the new caregiver program that Harpreet was talking about, that the criteria has now changed and has become even harder to get permanent residency. And that's linked to the higher education requirements, the higher English requirements. And then of course, during COVID, the dangerous and, you know, unfair and unsafe working conditions were even more exacerbated because of COVID, and workers continue to demand to remove the tied work permits, because care workers come here with closed work permits that tie them to one employer and prevent them from being able to leave employers and access protections, right? So some of these demands are demands that workers have been asking for decades, and others are new.
Sure. Harpreet, you mentioned that you're launching a series of demands on May 9th. Can you tell us where people can go to find these demands and support it if they can?
So we have one Facebook page, Caregiver Action Center. So they can go there and they can get all information over there.
And the petition will be available at landedstatusnow.ca.
Especially during the context of the pandemic, I don't know if this was spoken about, but how caregivers outside of the official healthcare system, because that's what a lot of, where caregivers work and are at, being excluded from the Guardian Angel program, and how that resonated maybe with your membership in terms of what was considered care work and what wasn't considered care work in terms of the conditions that, especially given the idea that guardian angels or people doing that kind of care work within the healthcare system were going to be given permanent residency.
Definitely. So the program, the guardian angel program that's granting some workers permanent residency excludes migrant care workers. And it's because in order to qualify for this program, you need to have been be a refugee claimant or have been a refugee claimant. You know, there's very specific criteria, and migrant care workers are coming here with work permits. They're not coming here with, you know, seeking refugee and trying to get seeking refuge from back home. I mean, migrant care workers are definitely coming here because of they're being pushed off of their own land for sure because of poverty and displacement and unemployment, you know, not having access to basic services as well. But so none of the care workers that are coming through the migrant care worker stream will be able to access this program, you know. And this, of course, is very frustrating because care workers do feel that their work is essential and important. And this is, of course, why their demands are to get permanent residency now.
I have one question in terms of the impact because of particular changes to the temporary foreign worker program, and especially the change and especially in terms of the live-in caregiver program, right? And pre the pandemic, and this was being billed as a sort of a positive impact in terms of the program. But do you feel that it was actually, it turned into more of a negative impact in terms of creating more loops towards permanent residency and creating more difficulties actually for migrant caregivers?
New caregiver program is most of affecting because they have a more requirement for permanent residency for higher education and ITS and the education assessment extra. So most eagles are not can't pass higher education. And they can't pass IELTS. Even the many girls are went 5-4 or so, like 6-7 times, but they didn't pass. And this task is very expensive too. And this is very big things for permanent residency for caregivers. So this is caregivers are very upset for this requirement for new caregivers program.
Definitely. And to add on top of the difficult English and education requirements, this program has also brought back a rule that you have to finish your 2 years of work experience within 3 years. And because of COVID, where quite a few workers were laid off, they're now scrambling to try to get a new work permit and continue to legally work so that they don't run out of time to apply for permanent residency. This is a really this is really scary and difficult for workers, and they just continued to be excluded from being able to access programs and get permanent residency, and are living without their families for a long time. So permanent residency is the solution that they're asking for.
No, absolutely. Can I ask one question? And just as because we dealt with the case here, and I know that Stefan probably already talked about the pandemic, and maybe just as a final question from me, one of the things around health and safety had been caregivers being dragged with their employers into these travel destinations, right? That were, you know, COVID hotspots, and not being able, feeling the right to refuse, you know, work, and thus actually testing positive and catching COVID as a result, but not being recognized as a workplace issue, because obviously the home is not a workplace, and traveling with your employer is not. So if that had actually been an issue at all for your membership.
No, they don't even, they don't allow to caregivers go outside. So even so many girls have stayed so many months, even so many girls are fired because they went for a walk or they went for some go for urgent work. Like that. So
I'm here, just give me 1 second. But
so they don't feel freedom in a COVID-19. They just say we are just in house. We are all this time stuck in the house. So even employers, they are themselves are going outside, but if their care workers going, they are fired because they went a walk or they went for to buy some things like that. Even if care workers are going for food or just send some money, and they don't allow to go.
Exactly. And definitely employers have been, care workers have been working in fear because employers are not restricted. They can move in and out of the home all the time. And you probably saw in the news that there was a care worker who did get COVID because of their employer, and then they had to quarantine in a hotel and they were fired while they were in quarantine. We've heard this happening within our membership, and this is ridiculous. This is no worker should have to go through this, where all of their rights and freedoms are just taken away from them, and they're not able to, of course, protect themselves in the way that they should be able to because of their temporary immigration status.
Wow. And yeah, again, it goes back to the question of being trapped in this apartheid because of the fear of never being able to get permanent residency, being temporary.
Exactly. And actually, just last week, I'm connected to a worker who did get COVID-19 and was told to quarantine and did get fired. So, of course, this is happening, and this is all invisible and happening behind closed doors, which is why care workers like Harpreet are speaking out about these horrible conditions and their real realities.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Do you want to one more time share how people can sign your petition, and until when that they have to contribute in that way, and where they can find more information about the work that you're doing in general?
So we are launching our petition May 9th, and they can go Caregiver Action Center. Mm-hmm. And
And just one more website called landedstatusnow.ca.
Yes.
Perfect. Well, thanks again so much for taking the time, and good luck with the petition and with the rest of your struggle.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
Yeah, really, it's inspiring and powerful. So thank you.
No problem.
Thanks, sir.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news I brought to you live.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on Thursday, April 15th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests, Triple Threat Lynn Tremblay on a life spent on stage and connecting virtually with an audience.
Just me with such a contact to people person, right? And doing it with this break the lens of the camera and go right through it and just talk to the people out there, you know, like that's my goal. And anyway, there's no good time, so might as well, you know, go. Let's get to it.
Rebecca Turner on writing a comedic vampire radio play entirely in Yiddish.
I have my friends who act as my muses on this one. We were all joking a few summers ago about all the things that we would do, all the things that we would create once we knew Yiddish way better than we did.
Choreographer Estelle Clareton derives inspiration from disaster to challenge the way she views the world.
I'm somebody very optimistic, and for me, humor is part of the medicine I use. and the beauty too, you know, I'm very sensible to beautiful things, even if sometimes I have a tendency to see darkness.
But before we begin, some updates. A week ago tonight, Premier François Legault dialed back the curfew in Montreal and Laval to 8 p.m. from 9:30 p.m.